The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
Post-Dobbs, post-referenda, a state referenda that turned out not well for us. The job before us is perhaps even more massive than we thought.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Bishop Laurie. He's the Baltimore Archbishop. He was speaking on how, man, there's a lot of work that lies before the nation's bishops in regard to fighting for life in this country. And I say, no kidding, huh? Let's pray for him. I'm glad God didn't call me to be a bishop. That's a tough run, huh? It really is. We should pray for our shepherds. Hey, it's good to be here with you today. Thanks for joining me. I mean that. Really great to be back. I want to thank Ed Morrissey for stepping in yesterday and taking the mic. Always great to have a pro behind the mic. And, of course, Maggie May, my producer. She took over for me and the chaplet yesterday. I got a lot of really great feedback. I want to thank Maggie and the whole team for making this happen. I'm back today. I hope you're getting ready for your Thanksgiving. A lot's happening. In fact, let me start with a report I've been following. Okay, and I mentioned this to you Friday. It's something I don't think there's enough reporting on. I think it's kind of horrible. There's been another Catholic church that's been hit by vandals. And I feel like I'm one of the few people that has been reporting on this. Catholic Vote's been doing it now, too. And I think a few other people picked up on it. And I think we should be talking about it. This time, it was St. Peter Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The parish is run by none other than the Marians of the Immaculate Conception. And those are just wonderful priests. You know Father Chris Alar and Father Calloway and Father Kazimierz Zwalik and Father Mark Barron. They're all Marians, right? This church is run by the Marians. Not that those guys are stationed there. They have this huge Divine Mercy image in the plaza in the front of the church, right? It's really beautiful. And I think it was yesterday morning or over the weekend, a priest woke up. They looked outside and they saw the image of Divine Mercy has been defaced. It was graffiti. There was spray paint on it. And there was some Egyptian word in green painted all over the image. The word referred to an ancient Egyptian symbol of the key of life and to a goddess that supposedly personified truth and balance and order and harmony and law and morality and justice. It's kind of ironic, right? Let me go and destroy somebody else's property. Let me deface a holy image. And we'll call that truth and balance. We'll call it order. We'll call it all of those wonderful things, morality and justice, right? It's ironic. Church has no security cameras. The police, have no leads in the case yet. So say a prayer, and hopefully, you know, if you have any information, call the local authorities. This type of stuff has really got to stop. And, you know, at the very heart of it is something dark. At the very heart of it is something demonic. I really believe that. It's demonic. That's why we see Satan lashing out. And I shared the story with you in the past. I won't get into it now about an exorcist who actually had to exorcise the rectory that he moved into because of some stuff that happened in it. And after the mass was said and the exorcism was performed, he went to bed that night. The next morning, he woke up on the outside of the church as though this was one final, you know, F you from Satan. It was the front of the church was spray painted with graffiti and all of these horrible words and just horrible, you know, images and things that were on it. But the exorcist said to me, he says, that was a sign. That was it. That was his goodbye. You know, he was vanquished and he was forced to leave. But that's what I see here with these images. I mean, there's often something sinister behind them. In Rwanda, and I've shared that with you before, there was a huge outbreak of this type of activity before the genocide occurred. So not that it's going to happen here in the country, but let's certainly pray for unity. Let's pray for unity in the church too. I heard that, you know, in 2025, you know, the year 2025 is going to be very significant for the Catholic Church for two reasons. First, it's going to be an ordinary Jubilee year, which is held every 25 years. Remember those Jubilee years? But it's also going to be, check this out, this is kind of an interesting little side note, the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. And that council, if you're not familiar with it, it defined the twofold nature of Christ, you know, as being both God and man. So looking towards that year, the Catholic Orthodox representatives are trying to meet because you know what they want to do? And I've always scratched my head around Easter. They're trying to arrive at a common date for the celebration of Easter. Now, if you ever listen to the show around Easter quite often on Holy Saturday on the Orthodox calendar, I talk about this incredible phenomenon that happens in the Holy Sepulchre, where a blue light comes from the very slab where Christ resurrected, and it lights the candles in the Holy Sepulchre. It's a phenomenon that's been recorded. It's gone back for centuries. And I often said, why does this happen on Holy Saturday? Why would the Orthodox? Why wouldn't it happen with the Roman Catholic Church, right? And of course, ever since the split, we have two, you know, different dates, right? And it looks like they're going to try to make that happen. Right now, the Orthodox use the Julian calendar. We use the Gregorian calendar. So it's rare that we actually celebrate Easter on the same day. So I think it would be great. I hope we see this. Turkish media reported that the Orthodox Patriarch of Constantinople is saying that you know, they're consulting with astronomers to help find the best date for the celebration. So let's pray for this. I think it'd be a big step towards unity with the Orthodox. We have this terrible split. John Paul II said that we are two lungs, right? Breathing in one body. We need to be united. We don't need to be divided. So I think that's good news. I think prayer changes things. You know that. Say a prayer today, right now if you can. Maybe a small sacrifice. You know, whatever you can do. And Lord, just have mercy. Bring unity. One other bit of church news. Quite often I deal with a lot of secular news. Maggie played that clip from Bishop Laurie. The U.S. bishops, and we need to pray for them too, okay? There are shepherds, you know, and I think the Holy Spirit works through them. They're committed right now to an intensified and widened fight against abortion. And I say bravo because, look, how many times have I taken your phone call here, right? Where you have said to me, why aren't we hearing more from the bishops? You know, why don't we hear from the pulpit? Why don't, you know, and I understand. Look, I share your passion. I do think there's a lot that goes on that we don't know behind the scenes with our bishops and leaders like Speaker Pelosi or Joe Biden or others that dissent. But that said, you know, with the election of the Archbishop from the Archbishop Timothy Broglio from the military archdiocese, he's now going to be the president of the conference. And Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, who just served a term as the chairman of the pro-life committee and as vice president, they're signaling, hey, bishops are committed to this fight that is a scourge on this country, like slavery was in the time of Abraham Lincoln. Abortion is our modern day scourge. And I can't believe people are so blind to it. If I walk down the street with a microphone and I put it up to anybody coming out of a mall and I said, do you think it's okay to have a slave? How many people do you think I would get that says yes to that? You know, that were of sane mind. Zero. Today it's okay to say, hey, you think it's okay if somebody murders a child in their womb? You know, there's going to be a day, generations from now, I hope it's not that far off, where they're going to look back like we look on slavery and say, oh my gosh, what kind of people could think that it was justifiable, that it was right, that it was okay to kill a child in the womb? That's insane. Yeah, I don't. That's my vantage point. I see that. I'm sure there were people in the time of Abraham Lincoln, abolitionists and others, who thought it was pretty insane that you can go over and chain up a human being and make them labor for you and abuse and beat them and destroy their family. And you see the same fingerprints on this as you do abortion. They're demonic, right? These are intrinsic evils. So we'll see what happens. We need to pray for our church. And we need to pray for this fight for life. A couple of quick stories here. Mary Rice Hasson is going to be stopping by. I want to get her on. I want to talk a little bit about a big piece of legislation happening. You know, I've been reporting on this too. And I just got some news over the weekend about this. I want to bring you up to speed on. But I'll get to Mary in just one quick second. I want to talk about the president, right? Happy birthday to the president. President Biden turned 80 on Sunday. So we wish him the very best. We wish him health. And I pray for his conversion on a daily basis. I'd invite you to do the same thing. Here's the question, right? Do you think Joe Biden will run for office again? Honestly, I mean, right now, if I said there's $1 million on the table, it's yours if you get the answer right. He'd be 82 if he got reelected. And 86 by the time he was finished his term. 86. Do you think he's going to run? Is it a liability as you get older like that? Your cognitive decline, you're not as sharp, you're not as energetic, you don't have the same energy level, you have health concerns. Yeah, of course, everyone sees age differently. It's not clear that this president is one of those younger, 80 years old, or one of those older ones. But on Monday, Karine Jean-Pierre, she held a press conference, a press gaggle aboard Air Force One, where she gave a response to a reporter asking whether or not the president was going to run.
Discuss whether he's running for president again in 2024 when it's with his family over Thanksgiving.
Look, I'm not going to get into private conversation that the president the president's going to have over the holiday with his family. I'm just going to, and I want to be careful, right, because it's we're talking about an election, and I'm covered by that Hatch Act. But what I will say is just reiterate what the president said, basically what you just said, that he plans to run in 2024. And like he said, just reiterating what you just said to me, is that he's going to have a conversation with his family, but not going to get into what, you know, when that's going to happen or what that's going to look like, especially since it's a private conversation that he'll have.
Well, since there wasn't a red wave in the midterms, right? I think the president thinks his policies are working. And will Kamala be his vice president? I don't know. We'll see. I tend to think he's going to run. I tend to think he's going to run, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know any more than you do, really. I vacillate. I go back and forth on the whole thing. There's a lot of questions being raised. His connection to China. CBS News finally acknowledged that, you know, the 2 years after the fact. And Hunter Biden's laptop. That's the real deal. I mean, is there a connection there? And will that play out? You know, speaking of China, one other issue here, and this is just so weird, right? I talked about how they're getting territory, they're buying up land next to our military bases. First buying. The Chinese government, apparently, they're setting up police stations. Did you hear about this? Chinese police stations in our country? Could you imagine a U.S. police station in Beijing? Check this out. In Thursday's Senate Homeland Security Committee hearing, Senator Rick Scott, he's a Republican from Florida, he questioned the FBI director, Christopher Wray. Check out part of this conversation. Listen.
It's been reported that the Chinese Communist Party are operating police stations in the United States in an effort to surveil Chinese dissidents. It seems obvious the U.S. shouldn't allow its most significant geopolitical rival, an oppressive communist regime, to establish police stations in the U.S. What authority or jurisdiction does the CCP have in the U.S.? And I don't know which one wanted to testify.
Well, Senator, like you, I'm very concerned about this. We are aware of the existence of these stations. I had to be careful about discussing our specific investigative work, but to me it is outrageous to think that the Chinese police would attempt to set up shop, you know, in New York, let's say, without proper coordination. It violates sovereignty and circumvents standard judicial and law enforcement cooperation processes. And the reason this is so important is because we have seen a clear pattern of the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, exporting their repression right here into the U.S. And we've had now a number of indictments that you may have seen of the Chinese engaging in uncoordinated law, quote-unquote law enforcement action right here in the United States, harassing, stalking, surveilling, blackmailing people who they just don't like or who disagree with the Xi regime.
Yeah, I think one of the key things he said there, it violates sovereignty. It circumvents the standard judicial and law enforcement cooperation processes. And it is pretty crazy when you think about it. Just on the surface, I sit back and I say, what? Hey, look, if you missed the conversations last week, go back to my my podcast and do a search for TikTok. I think we did two different shows looking at TikTok. So speaking of China, let me just throw one final thing out of here. TikTok's role in the midterms, right? I think it was over the weekend I saw this, or maybe it was last week. And we've been talking so much about TikTok. This hit my bullseye. You know, look, TikTok is a Chinese-owned company, right? It's owned by a Chinese company, I should say. And there's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. His name's Arthur Herman. He recently pointed out, they did a survey. They found that 40% of people between the ages of 18 and 24, now look at that voting demographic, and it came out for the midterms, right, in bigger numbers than they thought. 40% of people between 18 and 24 prefer using TikTok and Instagram as search engines over Google, right? So a Pew Research study found that 26% of adults and 30% of them get their news from TikTok. Now, if you're communist China and you got control of TikTok and you're able to create an algorithm like we saw in the other elections that repress certain news and advance other types of news stories or candidates. The question being raised, could it sway an election? Could it influence an election? Young voters. This is. I'll share with you what Art Herman said. He says young voters were a key voting block in the midterm elections. If a substantial percentage of those voters are getting their information about the world, including politics, from social media outlets owned by Chinese companies and running an algorithm being manipulated by Chinese cyber engineers, then we have a problem that goes beyond who has access to user data or even, you know, who won or lost the midterms. And I think that's very, very telling. I think we need to get this under control, and we need to do so very quickly. That's just food for thought. I'm going to continue to report on it. I'll continue to try to bring you up to speed on the latest. Back home, one final time, and I want to speak to Mary Hassan about this, the Respect for Marriage Act. I also, you do a search of our podcast for that as well. Some great conversation about this very disappointing piece of legislation. Once again, something that's being presented, this act is being presented as something very, I mean, who wouldn't want respect for marriage, right? Everybody wants respect in their marriage and for marriage, right? Sounds great. It's the complete opposite, right? It's absolutely sinister. Last week, the Senate voted to what's technically known as invoke cloture, right? Or bring an end to the filibuster. The so-called Respect for Marriage Act has a chance to be passed in the next couple of weeks. So the House, of course, already passed its version of the act. And if the Senate now passes, if they vote to pass their own version, then they would need to set up a conference committee to work out the differences and then bring the final version back to vote. So, you know, I thought it was over and done. So this is actually some good news, at least for me, the way I look at it. It means you can still call your senator, you can still call your representative, wherever they are, and say, hey, I want marriage respected. You know, and I can go through some of this with you, but I asked you last week, call your senator, have them vote against this. Guess what happened? 12 Republicans decided to join the Democrats in ending the filibuster. I think there were 18 Catholics in the mix, Democrat and Republican. But there's still hope we can stop it. Senator Mike Lee of Utah is encouraging his fellow Republicans to vote against the final version of the bill. And I want to applaud Representative Mike Perry of Pennsylvania. He actually voted to pass this thing. You know what he did? He came out and he did a mea culpa. He says, look, I'm sorry. I regret voting to pass it in the House. He's now encouraging his fellow Republican House members to vote against it. I wonder if he read it or if he said, well, that looks like a good bill. I'm going to vote yes. Right? Maybe he realizes what it is, or maybe you picked up the phone and called and said, hey, I want you to vote against this, and realizing what it represents. So there could be a significant obstacle, and that's the Mormon Church's official position, that they actually favor the bill after some slight changes were made. They believe it will help religious liberty. But I'm joined right now by Mary Rice Hassan, fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where she directs the Catholic Women's Forum, and it's always good to have her here with me here today. So, Mary, good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be with you.
I mean, I'm trying to remember the website. It's personandidentity.com. I was thinking as I was speaking because I want to plug that for you. I know I always want to defer to Catholic Women's Forum. Personandidentity.com is a great website. It'll help you understand the church's teaching on a lot of these different issues, especially help parents deal with children that might be misled by gender ideology. What do you make of this? I mean, sounds great, right? Respect for Marriage Act. What could be wrong with that?
Well, I think your commentary was spot on, because the name is an attempt to fool people, really, because there's nothing about this bill that respects marriage in its true sense. So it enshrines same-sex, quote, marriage into civil rights law. But at the same time, it does not specifically state that there's any protection. It calls for, quote, respect for people who hold different views about gender in marriage. It doesn't even say traditional marriage between a male and a female. So really what this bill is about is giving rights to, enshrining into civil rights law, this idea that same-sex marriage is the law of the land, national policy, and it sort of throws a bone saying, well, we're going to respect your beliefs if you believe in some other kind of marriage. But that gives you no legal protection at all. So right. Even the supposed religious liberty language in there is very, very weak. It's just a red herring.
In addition to what it will open the door to when it comes to how you define marriage and who can be married and coupled and whatever you want to call it. This is also problematic, isn't it, for religious liberty in this country? I know there's been major concern over that issue.
Yeah, and I think that's what people need to realize, that we really do need to double down and contact those senators who voted to end cloture, as you said, but who are going to be facing another vote. Are they going to vote for this? This bill offers no protection to Catholic schools. It offers no protection to faith-based charities that are engaging in the public square. It's just really going to lead to continuing litigation, harassment of people who try to live out their beliefs. It's one thing to say, oh, we respect your beliefs. But when there's no legal protection for you living it out in the public square, you're inviting litigation. And that's what this does.
So explain to me, if you could, why are the Mormons coming out in favor of this bill? Do they understand what the religious liberty implications are for this?
Yeah, so they have been steadily backtracking, unfortunately, by trying to find what they call a compromise, a way to validate the idea of same-sex marriage and as having rights under the law, and yet carve out protections for their own churches and their own ability to do the things that they do. So they backed Fairness for All, which was a compromise piece of legislation as an alternative to the Equality Act, and that didn't go anywhere either, because the religious liberty protections in that were just anemic. They were not worth much. So they've been steadily backtracking, and unfortunately they've signed on to this. And you can't speculate on motives, but what I observe is I think they're afraid. They think, we've lost this, so we're not going to fight. We're going to try to retreat into our churches and just don't compel us to perform same-sex marriages, which that's never been on the table. The left has not even tried to do that. So that's sort of one of the protections that's supposedly in this piece of legislation. Oh, no one's going to force you to perform a, quote, same-sex marriage. They could never get away with that under the First Amendment. We don't need this bill to do that. But instead, what this bill does is it basically says, if you don't buy into same-sex marriage, you're a bigot. You're a bigot. And, you know, we may say we, quote, respect you having those views, but it means that our tax exemptions are going to be jeopardized, our ability just to participate and live out those beliefs. So this is really key.
So just so I'm clear, you're saying there is no chance a Catholic church or any church is going to be required to perform weddings that aren't kosher, so to speak?
Everyone knows that's a losing position, because if the First Amendment means anything, it surely means that the government cannot compel a religious organization, a church, to do certain kinds of religious things. So that, and the left has not tried to force that issue either.
Yeah.
So by saying, oh, this bill is going to protect you from that, it's a way of saying, here, you know, that threat that's not really a threat, we're going to protect you against that. And say nothing about giving real protections for the very real threats.
Right.
Because we can see, Drew, you know, you look at everything that's going on in society. You have bakers, wedding photographers, you have adoption agencies. They're the ones who are under attack. And there is nothing in this bill that is going to protect their ability to live out their faith in a way that respects their conscience and their beliefs about marriage.
Well, Mary, I'm grateful for you. I only have about a moment left. How likely is it that the bill is going to be stopped? I know there's some Republican senators that voted against the bill. There are others that voted for it. So I don't know whether it's a political landmine, but what's your final thought?
So I think it depends on your listeners. I think it depends on people picking up the phone, getting on the email, and letting their maybe not just their senator, but the Republican senators who went the wrong way on this initial vote. They need to hear from people and realize, take a deep look at what's at risk here. And we don't want it.
Yeah.
Vote against it.
Amen to that. Well, Mary, thank you for your time. Always a delight talking with you.
Thank you.
Your website, personandidentity.com. Go check that out. Bookmark it. You'll be glad you did. Mary. Ryson Hassan is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And happy Thanksgiving to you, Mary. We'll catch up soon, okay?
Thank you.
All right.
Yep, you too. Bye.
God bless you. All right, when we return, we'll speak to the vice postulator for the cause of Maria Esperanza. Great story ahead.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, great to be with you today. Thank you for joining me. And I promise I'll give you a look at life you won't find anywhere else, whether it's dealing with current events or international affairs or politics or finance, but most importantly, the faith. And, you know, God has got a strange plan. He's got a plan and a mission for each and every single one of us. You know, years ago, I never, ever thought I'd be sitting behind a microphone here. As I've shared with you before, I thought I'd either anchor television news. God led me into the world of documentary filmmaking. I loved it. And during that process, back in, I guess it was 1989, I'll give you a little quick backstory here. I was in the jungles of Africa, and I was, I was present for the very last apparition of the Blessed Mother to a girl named Alphonsine Momoriki. And Alphonsine had visions of the Mother of God. And when she came to her, they told these children of a bloody future for Rwanda. This is 89 that this happened. When I was in that country, it was a beautiful country. It's the Switzerlands of the Africa. It's this tiny little landlocked country in the heart of Africa. People there had big hearts. They were wonderful. I never in my wildest dreams hearing some of these messages, I never reported on them because I thought, that's not going to happen, right? That's ridiculous. It's too dark, too macabre, too apocalyptic. Within 5 years, civil war erupts, and that nation literally turns into a bloodbath. The Hutus turned on the Tutsis, and we saw one of the greatest genocides in recent history. When I was there, I bumped into our Mariologist. His name was Father René Laurentin, and he was documenting these visions. He had traveled the planet. And I told him I was working on a documentary of these reported visions around the world. He said, well, then you've got to go to South America. There is a woman down there. Her name is Maria Esperanza. You know, and Esperanza in Spanish means hope, right? Maria, hope. So he says, you got to go down there. She's unbelievable. The Virgin Mary's been appearing to her throughout her life. She's had these mystical experiences. 1976, she started appearing in a place called Betania. And in 1984, 105 people were present there, 108, something like that. Every single one of them saw the Mother of God. They could see her as the seers in Fatima or any other place. It's normally for the visionary only. And he says, you got to go down there. And so I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. We scheduled a trip. I was one of the very first Americans ever to go to Betania. I remember coming down there. When I walked into her home, she says, I've been waiting for you. And I thought that was such a strange thing to say. And she began to talk to me. And she had these unbelievable gifts. Many people compare her to Padre Pio. She had the ability to read souls. She knew everything about me. I wasn't even married at that point in time. I was dating my future wife. She knew about my father. She knew he liked to gamble. She knew he had a drinking problem, you know, and she said these things. I'm like, how would this woman know any of this? She revealed things to me that nobody really knew. And I was awestruck. I remember departing Venezuela for the first time. This was, I think it was 89. I was down there for the very first time after that experience in Rwanda. And when I was there, it was like something out of a movie set. I mean, all these people, we were there at night, the moon was full, the water where, you know, so the healing waters of Betania flowed. Maria was in the center. They were praying. I came in there to say goodbye to her, and I'll never forget it. She told me I'd be back, and true to her prophecy, I'd return to Venezuela probably 13, 15 times. I would do a documentary on the events that happened there. And there were Eucharistic miracles that unfolded. I spoke to physicians. I spoke to bishops. I spoke to people of all walks of life that have been profoundly impacted by Maria Esperanza. She'd end up becoming the godmother to one of my children. She prophesied the birth of my first daughter. It's just an extraordinary, extraordinary woman. And she is, I think, up there with Padre Pio when you talk about some of the greatest
gifts, some of the greatest, being one of the greatest mystics of the 20th and 21st century, because the miracles that surrounded her were so vast, and they're among some of really the best documented in church history, and not since Padre Pio. You know, this incredible wonder worker, did we encounter a seer, a healer? She bore the wounds of Christ. Come Holy Week, her hands would get contusions and they'd erupt in these bloody wounds during the Passion. She had this odor of sanctity, this inexplicable, beautiful fragrance that often came from her. Competent eyewitnesses saw her levitating off the ground. So respected was she by the local episcopate, she was allowed to have our Lord have the Eucharist in her own home in a chapel that she had there. And she embodied so many mystical gifts that it's been amazing. I was with her when she bilocated at one time. So I know this stuff might sound strange. Some of these words you may not even understand. Bottom line is, if the church sees it, one day she may be raised to the altar. She may be declared a great saint. Right now, she's a servant of God. Then she'll become venerable. Then she'll become beatified and then a saint. So I often tell you, turn to the saints, but turn to those making their way to sainthood, the blesseds, the venerable servants of God. I think they intercede in a powerful way. They have special charisms. Clearly, Maria did too. I could talk for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, just on her extraordinary life. But I thought it'd be better today if we brought in the vice postulator for her cause, and that's Father Timothy Byerly. And he wrote a great book too. I want to get you plugged into it. I know you're probably saying, "I'd love to learn more about her." Grab a pen and paper. We'll get you plugged in. Father Tim, welcome back. It's good to have you here with me today.
Great to be back, Drew. Great to be back with you.
Always a pleasure. You and I have a deep connection and love for Maria. I remember in 89 when I first met her and I came back, I don't think anybody knew about her. And I put her in the Marian Apparition of the 20th Century film and then would go back and do a later one. She was extraordinary, even predicted some of what I think we're seeing today. But, you know, maybe you could, Father, share a little bit of her life story for those who don't know or put into context. I talked, of course, about some of these preternatural gifts that we've seen, but maybe you could talk about who she was, the charisms she had, and give a little backstory. Paint the picture of who Maria Esperanza was on this, the anniversary of her great birth.
I'd be happy to do that. And before I do that, though, I do want to note that, you know, those multiple trips that you made to Venezuela and the subsequent interviews that you did, which were transcribed, have become invaluable in this process, this beatification process, and learning the story of Maria Esperanza. Because she, in those interviews with you, the questions you asked, she opened up on some topics and some areas that even her family didn't know much about. And because it was, you know, it was before they were born or when they were young children. And so we continue to reharvest from the interviews that you did and are able to expound on the stories, expound on the life and virtues of Maria Esperanza because of those stories. So that was really wow. That was really a wonderful investment that continues to reap the profits.
Oh, praise God. We had her daughter on. Esperancita was with us a couple weeks ago too.
She did
for Betania too. And gosh, it feels like family. I'm so glad to have you here. But I'm going to shut up so you can talk. I want you to introduce everyone to this extraordinary woman and share whatever you'd like.
Yes. Well, let's just do a quick bio for her. You spoke about her mystical gifts. Well, she was born in the central area of Venezuela, and her father died when she was rather young, and she moved with her mom and her siblings to Caracas. And there she, her gifts started to become apparent at a pretty young age. In fact, even at age 12, she had a near-death experience. She had severe heart problems that the doctors wasn't sure we were going to pull through. And she had an encounter with Our Lady at that point and just surrendered herself to Our Lady. Was cured, healed, but in that surrender, Our Lady invited her to help her save souls. So from very early on, she had a mission of evangelization that was very Marian-oriented, and that continued to grow. Even in her teens, she started to have this ability to predict that when relatives were coming, you know, this is, you know, some of those places and have, you know, a lot of phone usage, and people would just stop in and say hello to relatives. She would predict the coming of aunts and uncles and cousins and so forth, and right on time they would show. These gifts developed over time, and when she was in her mid-20s then, she felt that, you know, she wanted to give her life completely to, and exclusively to Jesus. And so she joined the convent on the west side of the country of Venezuela, a Franciscan convent. She was only there, I don't know, less than 2 weeks when it was made clear to her through supernatural means that was not her calling. She was not meant to be enclosed in the monastery, in the convent there. Beautiful as a vocation that is, that was not her calling. And, you know, blessed be God, you know, for us, because, you know, Maria Speranza was then able, as a lay person, to be available to so many tens of thousands of souls upon whom she had an impact, upon whom she may have healed, upon whom she may have given perfect counsel, upon whose lives or marriages she may have reconciled. So these, you know, God knows what he's doing. In any case, Maria Speranza was called to Rome. She went to Rome. Now, this is a young girl, you know, traveling in the early 50s to Rome and just going there out of sheer faith. A priest in Venezuela helped her to find a hospice with some sisters, and so that's where she resided. In the meantime, she became quite known in the Vatican, believe it or not. It was in a rather hidden way. And so when she would enter the, she had finally met through providential circumstances her future husband, J.O.B. Ankeny, which is a whole beautiful story. That in itself would make an awesome movie. You should make that someday, Drew. It's a tremendous story. But in any case, when she walked into the Vatican in St. Peter's Basilica with Jayo, when he first met her, he was just dumbfounded at how all of the guards, all of the security personnel, all of the ushers knew her and paid reverence to her, this young woman. He didn't understand that, but she evidently her reputation for sanctity and special gifts had penetrated even to there. And although she speaks of, I mean, we don't have any real concrete way to substantiate this, but she probably had at least one or more encounters with Pope Pius XII. In any case, it was Pope Pius XII that allowed Maria Speranza to have her marriage, her wedding, in the Immaculate Conception Basilica Cathedral, Immaculate Conception Chapel in St. Peter's Basilica, which was an extraordinary permission. Very, very rarely granted, but it was granted for her. And so she was married there to J.O.B. Ankeny. They lived a little while in Italy and then came back to Venezuela. Now, this is when things started to accelerate, shall we say, in terms of her mission and what God was calling her to do. Because she had established a prayer group in Venezuela, and many people there Friday night, she would pray the rosary, and people would come and pray with her and want to be in her company and seek her counsel and prophecy and so forth. Well, Our Lady had promised that one day she would find a land, and this land would be very significant, even on a global level. And that was the land you were talking about earlier, which is Betania. It was when Maria Speranza was finally confirmed that this was the land was Our Lady was talking about. It's about 50 kilometers south or so, southeast of Caracas. It was a sugarcane plantation in the mountains. You know, it's kind of like tropical mountain area there. Yeah. And so the turning point of this mission of Maria Speranza occurred on March 25th, 1981. She was there with about 150 people. They brought a priest was with them. They had just celebrated Mass in the afternoon, and they were praying together. And then they just started to take a little lunch. And the children ran over to this open area now, which is, we call the grotto. It's in front of a rock formation that has a little waterfall coming down it and shrouded by foliage. And the children were playing some soccer. All of a sudden, they come running back to their parents and said, Mommy, Daddy, there's a lady over here. There's a lady over here. So the, you know, responsible said, guess everybody, let's go over and take a look. So 150 people went over that afternoon. And there, in front of that rock formation, the Blessed Mother appeared to all of them seven times for about 5 or 7 minutes apiece between them, between 3 and 6 p.m. or so. The last apparition where they were with Our Lady was 20 minutes long. They thought Our Lady was never going to leave them, and they felt like they were in heaven, and they were visited by heaven. And this was so transformative in their life. Of course, Mir Spranza knew it was going to happen, but from there, when everybody went back to their homes in Caracas and other places and told the story, it erupted into a major drama, shall we say, a major ecclesial drama. The people were claiming 150 people claiming to have seen Our Blessed Mother there in Venezuela, in Betania. So the bishop, who at that time Bishop Pio Bello, you know him because you interviewed him several times, Bishop Pio Bello Ricardo, was compelled to bring about an investigation, which he decided to conduct himself. He said it's going to, with all these witnesses, it's going to be impossible to try to pull a committee. You know how you know about committees, I'm sure. It's hard to pull a committee together for a meeting, for a parish council meeting, all right? So imagine interviewing 150 people with theologians and everybody's, but he was well qualified to do it himself because he had his doctorate in an area where he specialized in parapsychology. And so he was a Jesuit. He had been a university professor. He was an excellent theologian, and so he undertook this. But to be honest with you, he was extremely skeptical from the beginning, extremely skeptical. In fact, he could be quite harsh, quite abrupt with the witnesses. So when Maria Esperanza and J.O. Bianchini, her husband, were interviewed as, you know, one of the 150, he was quite rude to them. I mean, rude is the right word, and dismissive of the claims. But what happened is testimony after testimony, engineers, medical doctors, psychologists, there were even atheists there confirming the same story, college students, ordinary folks from the village, all these people across every strata of society announcing the same or professing the same vision, the same experience of this encounter with this woman. He couldn't just write it off. So he continued his study for 2.5 years, and he made various trips, several trips to Rome to speak to then Cardinal Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, about this whole issue. And he was given a specific book. You were going to interrupt him? Sorry, you were going to say something?
Yeah, no, Father, just hold the thought. I'm up against the clock. I think just a short pause here. Let's pick it up on the other side. My guest, Father Tim Byerly.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio Archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
Hey, thank you for joining me. It is good to be here with you today. If you're just getting plugged in, we will pray the chaplet in about 10 minutes. But reflecting back today on a woman who had a profound impact on my life and on my spirituality. Her name was Maria Esperanza. She came from a place where the Mother of God appeared, not just to her, but to the masses. It's a church-approved apparition. This very site was a reported Eucharistic miracle that Bishop Pio Bello also had investigated, found it to be another great miracle, another extension of God's grace. And I'd never met anyone like Maria Esperanza before. And I've invited today the vice postulator for her cause, Father Tim Byerly, to join me. He wrote a book, by the way. If you want to check this out, if you want to learn all of this, we're only going to be able to scratch the surface of what is a fascinating story and how God is really working in the world today and through the lives of those who say yes. And Maria had many charisms. Her family was such a beautiful fruit. The love that she showed everyone, there was a warmth. And I know she's a powerful intercessor for us today. The book that Father wrote is called Maria Esperanza and the Grace of Betania. Maria Esperanza and the grace of Tanya. Father, as you know, we probably have about 8 minutes or so. So let me do this. I'll let you. Why don't you pick up your story where you left off with the bishop? But then also, I'm curious as to where her cause is. I was there when her cause was opened in New Jersey when she became a servant of God. But the church has this process, as you know. And maybe you can bring everybody up to speed on where we are and you know, how we can in some way help.
Yes. Well, the we have 8 minutes, so I'm going to compress the story of Ms. Bronza. I want to highlight the fact that Bishop Pio Bayo investigated that apparition, all the apparitions there. There were more than one, but particularly that day, March 25th, 1981. He did a very extensive examination under the guidance of Cardinal Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, who was also, of course, in consultation with John Paul II on this. So on November the 21st, in 1987, Bishop Pio Bayo declared the apparitions in Betania as authentic, of supernatural character from God, which is a huge, what shall we say? That is an extremely positive embrace of the reality of the supernatural occurrences there. And so the church allows us then to have devotion to Our Lady under the title Reconciler of All Peoples and Nations, the title she came to Betania under. And we look to, especially to the servant of God, Mary Bronza, who was the central visionary of that apparition. So Mary Bronza then was blasted onto the world scene and began to make a lot of pilgrimages to various places, actually invited to give missions. She came often to New Jersey and other places in the United States of America. Her fame of sanctity spread. She was sought out by thousands of people for counsel, for healing, for prayer, for prophecy, and so forth. So that was so impactful in people's lives that when Maria Bronza was called home to God, there was an immediate interest in initiating her beatification cause. Now, it's important to mention that she didn't die in her home nation of Venezuela. She died in New Jersey. She died in Long Beach Island, New Jersey, on August the 7th, 2004. She was up here on a mission. Her health had been declining. She was unable health-wise to return home and eventually passed away here after a period of time. And her whole family came up for the occasion to be with her, I should say, until the end of her life. So that was 2004. So on January 31st, 2010, her beatification cause was opened in the Diocese of Metuchen, New Jersey. And it was about 1,200 people there. You were there. It was a splendid and magnificent moment of grace. And then there was we started going pretty strong with a cause on a number of aspects, and then it kind of interest kind of cooled a little bit with there were some changes of personnel and so forth. It seemed that you know we were stalled, and now there's been a renewed interest and a renewed passing of the baton and picking up with renewed zeal the beatification cause of Mary Bronza in Caracas, in the Archdiocese of Caracas. The cardinal, the new cardinal down there, is very excited about the cause, and the priest, Father Barachini, who is a title for him. He's called the vicar for beatification causes, canonization causes, for the archdiocese, and so this priest has a parish in the center of Caracas, and he has begun these monthly masses. In memory of the servant of God, Maria Bronza. And every month they have a mass invoking her intercession and then two or three testimonies, people who knew her, to speak about her life. So it's become a center of promotion of the life, virtues, knowledge, awareness of Maria Bronza in the country, the nation in which she lived her life, was born and lived her life. So this is a tremendous development. And we are very thrilled about it, and we are just watching it move forward. There's no way to put a time on it. There's no way to say you know, how long it's going to take, or, you know, so forth. The favors continue to come to be reported, Drew. Favors of an amazing healings, amazing reconciliations, amazing rectifications of disasters and things in people's lives through the intercession of servant God, Maria Speranza. So I would say to your listeners, she is a go-to intercessor right now, especially for the family, because that was her particular mission, to unite families. And she called for the reconciliation of the whole human family, one family at a time.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I'm glad you said that. We're about to pray the chaplet, and we'll certainly pray for your intentions, but I think that's so important. You know, Sister Lucia de Santos, Father, and I've often mentioned this, she did an interview with Cardinal Caffara, I think in the 1940s or something, and she said the final confrontation will be over marriage and family. And we see that right now. And Maria, you know, she exemplified what a true, loving family was really all about. And I've got somebody who's in real need of prayer. I'm going to turn to her and ask for her intercession. And I hope others will do the same thing. Your book, if people want to learn more, and I'll have to bring it back. There's so much we could talk about. But if people want to get your book, what's the best way to connect to it? Where will they find it?
From Batania, too, www.batania, regular alphanumeric 2, not a numeral, not a Roman numeral 2, regular 2, .org.
So that's